Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Jamie Murdoch.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Today, we're tackling a set of global sources that honestly paint a picture of some pretty extraordinary political and economic tension.
Yeah, it feels like we're looking at a world operating right on the edge, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Established rules, norms, they're being tested everywhere, from, you know, Washington courtrooms all the way to the Baltic Sea.
Absolutely. And our mission for you, our listener, is to really provide a thorough, comprehensive, and exhaustive look into the key developments covered in The Economist for the week of October 4th to 10th, 2025.
We're going deep on this one.
We are. We're focusing particularly on the immediate kind of high stakes impact of U.S. policy think, everything from a really unprecedented Middle East peace plan to a federal government shutdown back home.
And alongside that, there's this accelerating, almost ambiguous conflict people are calling gray zone warfare. It's really actively probing NATO's defenses right now.
Yeah, that gray zone element is fascinating and maybe a bit terrifying. What really defines this set of sources, I think, is just the sheer speed at which powerful actors are challenging the norms we've gotten used to.
Exactly. We're going to try and connect the dots for you between, say, U.S. presidential power grabs, Russia's attempts to destabilize Europe, but short of actual war, and these global economic systems that seem to be buckling under the pressure of new technology and, well, terrorists.
Okay, let's dive right in. We should probably start with something that has huge global implications, demanding, frankly, a level of detail we haven't seen much in recent U.S. foreign policy proposals. That's this 20-point eternal peace plan for Gaza, spearheaded by Donald Trump.
Yeah, this isn't just talk, is it?
Yeah.
The sources show a surprisingly robust proposal. The detail is kind of astonishing.
And the diplomacy behind it, too, getting endorsements from key Arab and Muslim countries right off the bat.
Right out of the gate. It's highly structured, and it seems focused on immediate, measurable results. I mean, at its core, the demands are pretty transactional, aren't they?
Yeah, like an immediate ceasefire.
An immediate cessation of hostilities, yeah.
Yeah.
Then Hamas must release all the remaining hostages. And Israel, in return, allows unlimited humanitarian aid access. That's actually a major concession from their side.
And then you get to the really politically difficult stuff for everyone involved, the Israeli withdrawal and what happens to Hamas fighters.
Precisely. The plan mandates a phased Israeli troop withdrawal. Phased. That's key. And it requires the complete disarmament of Hamas. That's non-negotiable in the plan.
So what's the offer to the fighters themselves?
Well, it's basically a choice designed to remove them from the equation permanently, politically, and militarily. They get either amnesty, but only if they're totally disarmed, or permanent exile. Get out of the region.
So theoretically, that stops the conflict just flaring up again immediately.
That's the idea. It's the crucial step to try and prevent that cycle.
Okay, what about governance? How does the plan try to set up something that isn't Israeli occupation, but also isn't Hamas control?
Right, that's where this sort of hybrid model comes in. It calls for establishing a technocratic, apolitical Palestinian committee.
Right.
So these are the guys who take over all the civil government stuff, water, electricity, schools, you know, the day-to-day things. The idea is to make sure Hamas has zero operational input into people's lives.
And who oversees this committee?
Ah, well, that committee reports up to a much higher authority. It's this proposed International Board of Peace.
And the chair of that board.
The source is very clear. Donald Trump is slated to chair it, which obviously gives it enormous geopolitical weight. Visibility.
He could say that.
But maybe more surprising, Sir Tony Blair is pegged to play a central kind of operational role.
The former UK prime minister. Okay. He certainly has experience in the region, though controversial for some.
Deep experience. Yeah. Contentious, maybe, but experience nonetheless. The whole structure seems designed to leverage that international legitimacy while making sure local technical expertise is actually used on the ground.
Okay, let's talk reception, especially in Israel. There seems to be this huge gap between public support and the fragility of the coalition government.
Yeah, the public reaction was, well, overwhelming initially. That first opinion poll showed a massive 72% of Israelis backing the plan. 72%.
That's huge. What's driving that? Hostages? Fatigue?
Both, I think. Deep fatigue with the conflict, absolutely. But also an urgent, desperate desire to get the hostages back. But, and this is the key thing, this huge wave of popular support isn't translating into political safety for Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's still polling really low, still feeling the fallout from the October 7th, 2023 attacks.
And implementation seems to hang entirely on his hard-right coalition partners,
right,
who have a totally different vision for Gaza.
They're the obvious political roadblock. Figures like Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, and Itamar Ben-Gvir, national security minister. They're very vocal proponents of Israeli resettlement in Gaza. They explicitly oppose abandoning the territory.
So the plan's ban on annexation or ongoing occupation is a deal breaker for them.
Absolutely. The sources predict that if Netanyahu actually tries to implement this plan, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir will almost certainly pull their parties straight out of the coalition.
Well, it means that government collapses.
And triggers new elections.
Yeah.
It puts Netanyahu in an incredibly difficult position.
If we look around for historical parallels, how likely is this kind of hybrid transitional governance to actually work in such a, well, volatile place?
That's a really important question. The sources make an interesting connection to the experience of Kosovo. Potrat Salimi, who used to be Kosovo's foreign minister, argues this model can work, but only if the international buy-in is really broad and crucially sustained over time.
Kosovo's different, though, isn't it? Twice the size.
It is different, yeah. Twice the size geographically. Yeah. But the model they used combined that international oversight with strong local ownership. That seemed to be the key.
So what was the successful mechanism there we should be looking for here?
It seems to be this blend of legitimacy and local know-how.
Mm-hmm.
International organizations brought the legitimacy, the reconstruction money, which is vital. But local leaders brought the cultural understanding, the day-to-day expertise needed to actually govern without it all falling apart into internal squabbles.
Hmm.
Salimi himself notes the parallels aren't perfect. Kosovo was post-conflict, not partially occupied territory like Gaza. But the principle holds. Having a highly visible, robust, internationally backed Board of Peace, chaired by someone like Trump, could potentially navigate both the internal Palestinian political dynamics and the external demands, like from the UN Security Council. It might offer a path to medium-term stability, at least.
Okay, so from these high-stakes peace efforts abroad, we plunge right into, well, self-inflicted chaos back in the U.S. A total gear shift here. We have to talk about the first federal government shutdown since 2019. What was the actual trigger? It sounds almost trivial.
It was relatively minor in scope, wasn't it? A dispute over health insurance tax credits that just got jammed up in the Senate appropriations process. But the consequences?
Catastrophic. The political failure was just a basic breakdown in compromise.
Pretty much. And the immediate impact.
Yeah.
750,000 federal workers furloughed. Just like that.
Though we should probably stress, right? Essential services like military, air traffic control, they keep going.
Hmm.
But the workers don't get paid.
Exactly. No paychecks. And that has knock-on effects, obviously. But the wider economic impact of this shutdown is really complicating things for policymakers, especially the Federal Reserve, right in the middle of these very contentious interest rate debates.
How so?
Well, the shutdown immediately delayed the release of crucial economic stats. Most importantly, those monthly employment figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So the Fed is basically flying blind, trying to make huge decisions without knowing the current state of the job market.
Historically, the direct hit to GDP from shutdowns has been pretty small, right? Like the 2018-19 one knocked off maybe 0.02%.
Tiny, yeah, in the grand scheme of GDP. But it's the political use of the shutdown that's really got the institutionalists worried this time.
You're talking about that memo from the OMB director, Russell Vaught.
Exactly. This is where the potential for long-term institutional damage really lies. The sources highlight this memo Vaught circulated. And it wasn't passive. It was actively encouraging department heads right across the government to use this funding lapse as a political weapon.
A weapon how?
The directive was explicit. Use this opportunity to fire potentially thousands of federal workers whose roles don't align with the president's stated priorities.
Wow. So weaponizing the shutdown itself to reshape the civil service. How high is the risk that this sets a permanent precedent? That every shutdown now becomes an institutional purge.
The risk seems extremely high. It really reflects this profound, deep-seated antipathy within parts of the Republican Party towards the permanent federal bureaucracy, the so-called deep state, which they see as inherently resistant to the executive's agenda.
Is that even legal? Firing people during a funding lapse?
Well, there's no black-letter law explicitly allowing it. But a former OMB official, quoted, a guy named Kogan, warns that the administration's actions move way faster than the courts can react. By the time a judge issues an injunction or rules against it,
the damage is done.
Exactly. Institutions like the EPA, the State Department, they could already be hollowed out. You achieve an ideological goal through, essentially, institutional sabotage.
And this feeds right into that bigger conversation about accumulated presidential power, doesn't it? Which the Supreme Court is now actively digging into as the new term starts. The sources point to three really defining cases.
Yeah, you see the judiciary caught in this incredibly complex balancing act. They need to define the limits of executive power, but without triggering a full-blown constitutional crisis.
Yeah.
The most closely watched case is Trump v. Slaughter.
Right, that's the one about firing heads of independent agencies.
Exactly. Can the president sack the heads of independent agencies without cause? Historically, that's been protected by a 1935 precedent, Humphrey's executor. That case established that officials at places like the Federal Trade Commission needed cause for removal, precisely to protect their independence from political winds.
And the prediction is the court might actually side with the executive here, overturning almost a century of practice.
That is the prediction, surprisingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, depending on your view. If the court does side with the executive, it hands the president massive, immediate power over the entire regulatory state. Think EPA, FCC, FTC.
But maybe not the Fed.
That's the potential carve-out. The analysis suggests the court might make an explicit exception for the Federal Reserve. The Fed governors, like Lisa Cook, they might be protected because the Fed has this unique sort of quasi-private structure. Its independence is seen as just crucial to global financial stability.
So the court might be wary of sparking a global economic panic by putting the Fed directly under White House political control.
That seems to be the thinking. They might draw a line there.
But where else are they drawing lines? Are they pushing back against the more ideological pushes?
It looks like they are resisting the most, shall we say, ideologically fringe requests. Take the case about birthright citizenship. The court is expected to stand pretty firm on the 14th Amendment there. They'll likely resist the president's attempt to deny citizenship to babies born in the U.S. to non-citizens.
Okay, so that suggests while they might grant the executive more regulatory power, they're still holding the line on fundamentally reinterpreting core constitutional rights.
That seems to be the emerging pattern, yes.
And then there are the tariffs cases, which have this weird AI prediction element.
Right. We have to mention the SCOTUS spot. For listeners who haven't encountered it, it's this AI model trained on decades of case filings, judicial voting records, legal history, all designed to predict Supreme Court outcomes.
And what's the prediction for the tariffs cases? Bad news for free traders?
Unfortunately for them, yes. The SCOTUS bot predicts presidential success in these key cases involving tariffs on imported goods like specialty wine, toys, you name it. If that holds, it grants the executive massive, almost unilateral control over trade policy, a huge expansion of presidential authority in that area.
So, taken together, the court seems to be granting immense power to the executive, really shifting the balance of checks and balances.
It certainly looks that way based on these initial signals and predictions. It could fundamentally alter how the U.S. government operates.
Okay, let's pivot again. Another front in this administration's policy battles. The really aggressive stance against high drug prices, specifically implementing this most favored nation, or MFN, pricing.
Yeah, this is a direct political demand, isn't it?
Yeah.
The president has basically told drug makers, cut your U.S. prices down to the lowest price you offer in any other rich country, or face the full administrative arsenal.
And the premise seems reasonable on the surface, right? U.S. list prices for branded drugs are often, what, four times higher than comparable nations?
They are. The disparity is stark. But the sources lay out a really detailed counterargument. They highlight that America's high prices, however uncomfortable, play this absolutely indispensable role in subsidizing global pharmaceutical innovation.
How does that work? The high prices here pay for R&D everywhere else.
That's the critical economic mechanism they argue is at risk. Pharma development is incredibly high stakes, high failure. Roughly 90% of drugs that enter clinical development fail. They cost billions. High U.S. revenues essentially fund that global R&D pipeline. They finance the big risky bets on truly novel therapies.
And there's data showing the impact if that funding shrinks.
Yes, there is. Between 2014 and 2022, nearly half of all new drugs approved in the U.S. never got approved in Japan. One in five never won approval in Europe.
Wow.
It suggests profitability of the U.S. market really incentivizes the creation of drugs that might otherwise just never get developed or launched globally.
Wow.
So the argument goes, if you impose MFN pricing and drastically cut the potential rewards, the industry's appetite for that kind of risk just plummets.
And the result could actually be worse care and less access to cutting-edge drugs for Americans down the line.
That's the fear. Fewer innovative drugs being developed overall, potentially hitting Americans hardest in the long run.
So if the administration pushes ahead and successfully enforces MFN, how do the drug companies react? They won't just take a massive revenue cut, surely.
Oh, absolutely not. They have very sophisticated financial and legal teams ready for this. Analysts predict two main workarounds. First, firms will likely delay launching new products in cheaper, smaller markets. Why? To keep their official declared MFN price artificially high based on the remaining more expensive markets.
Okay, that hurts access in smaller countries. What's the second workaround?
They'll probably raise list prices everywhere, globally, but then offer opaque rebates and privately negotiated discounts to foreign governments and insurers. This allows them to claim they're meeting the MFN requirement based on the inflated list price, while actually maintaining, or maybe even increasing, their net price in many foreign markets through these hidden deals.
Have we seen this kind of thing before? Are there precedents?
Yes. Research into similar MFN-style pricing rules already tried in parts of Europe showed they were pretty ineffective at lowering U.S. prices. But, crucially, they did delay drug launches in 8 low-income countries by up to a year.
So the main consequence might not be cheaper drugs in the U.S., but actually stifled access globally.
That's what the evidence suggests. It could force the U.S. administration to either eventually back down or face significant diplomatic blowback from other countries struggling to get new medicines.
That discussion about global impact provides a really good bridge, actually. Moving from domestic policy disruptions to the global stage, where military and political stability is being tested in really ambiguous ways. Specifically, let's talk about Vladimir Putin's accelerated gray zone campaign against NATO. How should we even define this threat? It's slippery.
It is slippery. Gray zone is basically conflict conducted short of outright war. That's the key. It's carefully calibrated aggression, designed to cause maximum disruption, sow chaos, undermine confidence. But crucially, ensuring none of the individual actions clearly cross the threshold for invoking Article 5. It's not a casus belli, not an armed attack, justifying a full military response from NATO.
So it's that quote from the German Chancellor, not at war, but no longer at peace.
Exactly that. It's this intermediate, unstable, deeply uncomfortable state.
And the sources detail how widespread this is geographically. It's not just border stuff.
No, that's what makes it so chilling. It's a distributed campaign right across the alliance's periphery. And even deep inside, we've seen Russian decoy drones shot down way inside Polish territory, reports of MiG fighters buzzing Estonian airspace, testing response times.
But also targeting critical infrastructure within NATO countries.
Yes, civilian infrastructure, power plants, oil refineries, even a key arms factory owned by ThyssenKrupp up in Schleswig-Holstein, Germany, all have had documented drone sightings nearby. And then, of course, there are the damaged telecom cables under the Baltic Sea.
And the beauty of it from Putin's perspective is that each incident is deniable or cheap.
Both. Deniable, cheap, and designed to create this cumulative systemic stress on NATO and its members.
So what are the strategic goals here? What's Putin trying to achieve long term with this kind of campaign?
The goals seem primarily political and psychological, aimed right at the West's internal stability. First, it just undermines faith in the competence and resilience of liberal democratic governments. Russia's economy is tiny compared to the West, smaller than Italy's GDP. They can't compete head-on, so they attack Western wealth and infrastructure using these cheap, asymmetric methods.
Okay, undermine competence. What else?
Second, by sowing discord and chaos, it naturally benefits populist nationalist movements within Europe. Many of those movements share Putin's fundamental suspicion of a united Europe in institutions like NATO and the EU.
Makes sense. And third?
Third, and maybe most importantly right now, It tests NATO's cohesion. It highlights any American ambivalence, especially given President Trump's past statements questioning collective security. Every ambiguous incident forces NATO allies to debate. How do we respond? Is this Article 4, Article 5? And any hesitation or disagreement is a win for Moscow.
And this creates openings for others, too, like China.
Absolutely. China is watching closely and employing very similar gray zone tactics near Taiwan. They see America's focus potentially shifting, maybe its commitment to upholding that post-1945 security order waning. It emboldens them.
So if direct military retaliation is deliberately kept off the table by the nature of these attacks, what can NATO and the EU do? The sources suggest a kind of three-pronged response.
Yeah, the recommended response is more structural and political than purely military. The first prong is all about swift exposure and attribution.
Meaning,
immediately publicize the forensic evidence. Link the attacks, whether it's drone debris or damaged signatures on cables, directly to Russian state or state-sponsored actors. You have to strip away Russia's deniability. That shifts the cost back onto Moscow, both in global opinion and, crucially, among Western voters who need to understand the threat.
expose an attribute. What's prong two?
Prong two is hardening the targets. Improve resilience. This is the less glamorous but absolutely necessary work. It means building redundancy into critical infrastructure, backup data cables, more decentralized power grids, investing in rapid cyber response teams.
And dealing with the sheer number of cheap drones.
Exactly. Developing cheaper, mass-produced interceptor systems to counter the tens of thousands of inexpensive drones Russia can now deploy. You can't use multi-million-dollar missiles against $10,000 drones forever.
Right. And the third prong, imposing clear costs. What does that look like beyond just standard sanctions, which seem limited in effect sometimes?
It requires more creative thinking. Beyond hitting specific suppliers involved in attacks, the sources strongly emphasize using those frozen Russian assets. There's a huge pile of immobilized Russian state funds sitting in Western banks.
Use them to pay for
Ukraine's defense. Use them to repair NATO infrastructure damaged by these gray zone attacks. That establishes a direct, clear financial consequence for continuing the aggression. Make the perpetrator pay, literally.
This gray zone feels like it extends dramatically onto the seas as well, with this massive growth of the shadow fleet. That sounds like a fundamental breakdown of maritime governance.
It really is a critical failure. The shadow fleet is basically ships concealing their identity, usually by turning off their automatic identification system, their AIS transponder. It's a tactic called going dark.
The kind of thing North Korea and Iran used to do to bust sanctions.
Exactly. They pioneered it. This fleet, which is largely dedicated to smuggling Russian oil right now, but also does plenty of other illicit stuff globally, has just exploded in size from maybe 200 vessels back in 2022 to nearly 1,000 today.
1,000. That's a huge number.
It's enormous. And it represents this giant, floating, largely unregulated platform for criminal activity, sanctions busting, and potentially state-sponsored espionage.
And this rapid growth is leading to actual hostile incidents at sea.
Absolutely. We've seen shadow tankers, like one called the Eagle S, implicated in cutting critical communications cables, like the ones in the Gulf of Finland recently. And the situation really highlights how vulnerable some of the smaller NATO navies are.
Like in the Baltics.
Yeah, the sources quote the Estonian naval commander. He described their frustration trying to track and interdict these huge, often old and unsafe, illicit tankers. He said it was like smaller dogs trying to get to the big dog. They just don't have the ships or the legal authority often.
And Russia is actively protecting this fleet. That signals how important it is to them.
Critically important. There was a key incident where the Estonian Navy tried to detain a sanctioned tanker called the Jaguar, Russia's response. They immediately scrambled fighter jets into Estonian airspace to protect the tanker. They essentially declared the Shadow Fleet a critical national interest to be defended by military force if necessary.
So what can the West do? NATO's trying things like the Baltic Sentry mission. Legal harassment?
They are. Increased patrols, more legal harassment, checking paperwork, safety records, insurance, trying to make life difficult for these ships. But the fundamental problem remains. International waters, the principle of innocent passage, they severely limit what Western navies can legally do to stop these vessels unless they catch them red-handed committing a crime.
So the outlook isn't great.
The consensus among naval analysts seems pretty grim. This genie of unregulated, hostile maritime activity.
Yeah.
It's not going back into the bottle anytime soon.
Okay, let's shift from military gray zones to economic brinkmanship. The USMCA trade agreement, the successor to NAFTA, seems to be under massive pressure from the U.S. administration's use of tariffs.
Yeah, the USMCA, covering the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, was specifically designed to shield its members from those kinds of blanket tariffs. It guaranteed trade rates far below the global average, which the U.S. applies elsewhere, around 17%.
But the current administration is finding ways around that.
Systematically eroding those protections, yes. Primarily by imposing tariffs using national security grounds. That's the loophole. They're slapping these tariffs on things like steel, aluminum, and crucially car parts and finished vehicles. It lets the U.S. bypass the agreed-upon duty-free terms within USMCA.
So the U.S. is just ignoring the explicit duty-free quotas for vehicles that were agreed in the treaty, like 2.6 million vehicles from Canada and Mexico each.
That's exactly right. Those quotas are effectively being ignored. Instead, the U.S. is imposing this really debilitating 25% tariff based on a complex calculation of the non-American content in finished vehicles.
That sounds like an administrative nightmare.
It's incredibly complex to administer, hugely disruptive. It forces manufacturers into massive efforts tracking the origin of every single component. and it fundamentally undermines the deeply integrated, just-in-time North American supply chain that took decades to build.
How much of the trade between the three countries is actually affected by this now?
The estimates suggest up to a third of all USMCA trade is now subject to these tariffs, or at least the threat of them. And that instability is just bad news for all three economies, which rely heavily on that seamless cross-border flow of goods for manufacturing.
And there's a formal review of the USMCA coming up in 2026. Mexico and Canada must be worried.
They are, and they're clearly trying to get aligned. We saw reports of Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney meeting with Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum specifically to coordinate their strategy ahead of that 2026 review.
What are the expected flashpoints?
Two big ones seem clear. First, those rules of origin for cars will be heavily contested. The U.S. wants tighter rules. Second, the reliance of North American supply chains on China. That's a major U.S. grievance. Mexico, in particular, has seen a big increase in imports of Chinese goods, cars, electronics components. The U.S. sees this as a kind of backdoor for China, and that's expected to be a central target in the review negotiations.
Okay, turning towards Asia now, Japan's political landscape is looking pretty unstable too, with a leadership crisis in the ruling LDP party. And it seems to represent a really fascinating ideological split.
Yeah, the LDP is currently governing with a minority, which has forced this leadership contest. And the two main contenders couldn't be much more different, ideologically speaking. Mm. On one side, you have Koizumi Shinjiro. He's only 44.
Young for Japanese politics.
Very. Mm. He represents the modernist, moderate, kind of big tent faction of the party. If he wins, he'd be Japan's youngest post-war leader. He signals a more flexible, maybe less ideological approach to policy.
And contrasting him is Takaichi Sane.
Right. Takaichi Sane, she's 64. She represents the more ideological traditionalist wing, very much channeling the nationalism of the late Abe Shinzo. She's considered a hardliner.
What does that mean in policy terms?
She advocates for controversial policies like revising Japan's pacifist constitution. She fiercely protects socially conservative principles, like ensuring only males can inherit the imperial throne. And she favors maintaining a pretty dovish monetary policy. If she wins, she'd be Japan's first female leader, historically significant, but marking a sharp ideological shift.
Whoever wins faces immediate challenges, right? Particularly from the U.S.
Absolutely. The new leader walks straight into preparing to host Donald Trump in late October, and the top agenda item will be following up on that previously vague trade deal, the one requiring Japan to commit to investing an absolutely astounding $550 billion in the American economy.
$550 billion, that's huge.
It's massive. And domestically, they also have to deal with severe public anger over stubborn inflation and years of stagnant real wages. They need to convince the Japanese public that the LDP can actually deliver economic relief, not just political stability.
Okay, let's shift our focus now more towards disruption and innovation, starting with technology and the robotaxi revolution. This seems like a sector where the reality on the ground in some places is just racing way ahead of the rules.
Well, completely. It's a textbook example of how different regulatory approaches, particularly East versus West, can really accelerate or stall innovation. If you look at Shenzhen in China or San Francisco in the U.S., the future is basically here already.
The numbers are pretty wild, right?
They're staggering. Waymo, that's Google's company, and Baidu in China, they each conducted 2.2 million robotaxi trips in just the second quarter of 2025 alone. 2.2 million each.
And that scale gives us real data on safety.
Compelling safety data. Waymo vehicles, according to the stats cited, are involved in 92% fewer injury claims per mile driven compared to human-driven cars. 92% fewer injuries.
That's a very strong safety case. Yet Western regulation seems almost designed to put the brakes on. What are the main hurdles?
The regulatory barriers are immense, especially in the U.S. and Europe. Often they're driven partly by genuine safety concerns, but also, critically, by fears about job losses for human drivers.
So what specific rules are slowing things down?
In the U.S., the main federal agency, the NHTSA, limits the deployment of non-standard vehicles, you know, the futuristic ones without pedals or steering wheels, to just 2,500 per year per company. That's a tiny number if you want to operate at scale.
A drop in the ocean compared to 2.2 million trips a quarter.
Exactly. And then you have major cities stepping in. New York City currently bans autonomous vehicles being used for paid taxi services. Boston is considering rules that would require a human safety operator inside every single autonomous cab. That kind of defeats the purpose.
So the argument in the sources is that this resistance, especially at the city level, is maybe less about safety now and more about protecting taxi driver jobs.
That certainly appears to be a primary motivation behind some of these local bans and restrictions. But the interesting thing is, the actual economic reality playing out in San Francisco seems to challenge that job loss narrative.
How so? What's happening there?
Well, the data suggests that robotaxis aren't primarily replacing man taxis or rideshare drivers. They seem to be replacing private car ownership or trips people might not have taken otherwise. The overall demand for rideshare services, including human-driven ones, has actually grown in San Francisco since robotaxis launched at scale.
Grown. That's counterintuitive. So human drivers are actually benefiting.
It looks that way. Surprisingly, human taxi and limousine service employment in the city grew by 7% year-on-year, and total driver pay was up 14%.
Why would that happen?
Possibly because the overall market for mobility as a service expanded, and human drivers are still needed, maybe even more so for peak demand times or for trips where speed is essential. Robotaxis are still generally slower. They obey all traffic laws religiously, no speeding, no rolling stops.
Right, they don't take risks.
Never. And they're still more expensive, maybe 20% to 40% more than a human-driven service. So if you need to get across town quickly during rush hour or you have complex needs, you're probably still hailing a human cab for the foreseeable future.
Fascinating. Okay, let's shift gears to another disruptive technology, cryptocurrency, specifically stablecoins. The US passed the Genius Act, which seems to legitimize them, but the worries about instability haven't gone away, have they?
Not at all. In fact, they might have deepened. The Genius Act was a big deal, allowing major traditional financial institutions to launch their own stablecoins. That gave the sector a massive boost. Tether, which is the dominant stablecoin, saw its market value jump 46% to $174 billion right after the announcement.
So they promised stability, a digital dollar essentially, but what's the risk?
Well, the Nobel laureate John Tyrol had this warning, cited in the sources, that financial innovations that seem really safe often introduce unforeseen systemic risks. He compared it to the lead-up to the 2008 crisis, with complex derivatives that everyone thought were safe. Stablecoins promise stability, but they face run risks.
Like we saw with Terra USD, the algorithmic one.
Exactly. The algorithmic ones are inherently risky, as the Terra USD collapse in 2022 showed $40 billion just vanished in days. But even the ones that claim to be fully backed by real assets, like dollars in a bank, are vulnerable.
How so, if they're fully backed?
Because fully backed can be an illusion, or the backing itself can be risky. Tether, for instance, has faced fines for misrepresenting its reserves in the past. And even Circle, which runs the USDC coin and claimed full reserve backing, had about 8% of its reserves trapped and potentially lost when Silicon Valley Bank collapsed back in 2023. If the bank holding your reserves fails, your full backing suddenly isn't so full. A run could still happen.
And the Genius Act itself, does it address these risks adequately?
That's the concern. Critics say the act is actually quite light on specific detailed rules about how redemptions would work in a crisis. This raises the likelihood that if a major stablecoin faces a run, the government might feel pressured to step in and bail out the holders.
Why would they do that?
Partly to prevent financial contagion, but also maybe to protect the reputation of the U.S. as this newly crypto-friendly jurisdiction. This push for light-touch supervision seems amplified by the current administration's, well, ideological leanings and maybe even some financial incentives towards promoting crypto. There's mention of a venture backed by the Trump family that issued its own stablecoin, USD1.
And how does this play out globally? Europe must be watching this.
They are, nervously. Europe is worried about imposing their own tighter regulations on these dollar-based stablecoins.
Yeah.
They fear that if they do, the U.S. will immediately cry foul and frame it as an unfair trade barrier against American financial technology.
So geopolitical tension over regulation makes it even harder to build global guardrails for this fast-growing but potentially unstable asset class.
Precisely. It complicates the whole picture significantly.
Okay, let's stick with Europe for a moment, but shift to broader innovation. There's an argument in the sources that Europe is facing a real innovation crisis, partly because of its own rules specifically, labor laws acting as a kind of straitjacket.
Yeah, the data points to a genuine structural problem. Europe, compared to America over the last couple of decades, and if you look at the biggest companies, U.S. firms dominate the truly massive trillion-dollar sectors of the future: AI, reusable rockets, global social media platforms.
Whereas European giants are mostly.
Mostly selling, as the source puts it, improved versions of 20th-century products. Cars, chemicals, luxury goods. They're masters of incremental improvement, making existing things better. but they seem to struggle with creating truly disruptive, category-defining innovations that lead to superstar growth.
And the core argument connects this directly to Europe's strict 20th century style labor laws, the ones designed to maximize job security. How does that link work?
It's fundamentally about the cost and consequences of failure. Truly disruptive innovation requires making huge, expensive, risky bets. Think developing a totally new kind of battery or pouring billions into AI research that might lead nowhere. Most of these big bets statistically will fail.
Like the Apple Car project recently.
Exactly. When Apple decided to shut down its multi-billion dollar car project, they could relatively quickly and, in corporate terms, cheaply, lay off thousands of engineers and reallocate those resources, that talent, to other projects like AI. That agility is crucial.
And in Europe.
In Europe, if a company makes a similar huge bet and it fails, the strict labor laws make mass layoffs incredibly expensive, legally complex, and protracted. It can take years and cost a fortune in severance and legal fees. This drastically drives up the cost of failure.
To the point where companies just avoid taking the risk in the first place.
That's the argument. The potential downside is so high that European firms tend to shy away from the necessary large risky bets required to achieve that kind of trillion-dollar disruptive growth. They stick to safer, incremental innovations that protect existing jobs. But, the argument goes, condemn the continent to slower overall growth in the long run.
So, if the goal isn't necessarily to become just like the U.S., what kind of policy adjustments are suggested? How could Europe loosen this straitjacket without totally abandoning its social values?
The suggestions focus more on targeted tweaks rather than a wholesale bonfire of regulations. One idea floated is making it selectively easier to dismiss the highest-paid tech workers, the argument being they need less social protection and find new jobs more easily.
That might be controversial. Is there a broader model?
A stronger, perhaps more politically palatable model proposed is to look towards Scandinavia, the flexicurity model. Basically, you ease the rules around firing, making it easier for companies to adapt, restructure, or shut down failed projects quickly. But crucially, you simultaneously provide extremely generous unemployment benefits and robust retraining programs funded by the state.
So you balance corporate agility with social security.
Exactly. It balances the company's need for flexibility, allowing them to fail fast and pivot with comprehensive social protection for the individual worker. The idea is to shift the financial risk of failure away from the company's balance sheet and more onto the government's social safety net. That, theoretically, makes taking those big, disruptive bets viable again for European firms.
Okay, let's transition now to some briefer but still high-impact regional flashpoints, and then we'll conclude with a couple of deeper dives into culture and, well, human endeavors. First up, Madagascar. The protests there seem to reflect something much deeper than just temporary anger.
Oh, absolutely. The crisis in Madagascar is profound. It looks like systemic collapse. You've got protests sweeping the capital, Antananarivo, over these persistent, crippling power cuts, severe water shortages, and just rampant corruption. It's boiling over into calls for the president, Rajoelina, to resign.
And there's that detail about the cable car.
Yeah, the sources highlight this tragic irony. There's this highly publicized French-financed cable car system. It was meant to be a symbol of modernity for the capital, but it rarely runs because of the very power cuts it was supposed to help alleviate. And even when it does run, it's far too expensive for ordinary locals to actually use. It's become this physical monument to a completely failed elite project.
And the economic backdrop is just devastating, isn't it? Making Madagascar a real global outlier.
The statistics cited are genuinely horrifying. GDP per person there has actually shrunk by half since 1960. Half. That's a decline larger than any other nation on Earth that hasn't gone through a major civil war.
How is that even possible?
Infrastructure has crumbled. They might have half as many paved roads today as they did back in 1960. The country is described essentially as a mafia state, where a very narrow elite just plunders the island's incredible natural wealth, trafficking gold, lynchets, precious rosewood, even its unique endemic lemurs. It's tragically become this treasure island looted by modern-day pirates.
Meanwhile, shifting regions, the stability of Iraqi Kurdistan, which for a long time was seen as the other Iraq, a relative success story, seems to be collapsing under the weight of internal feuding.
Yeah, this is really disheartening. It's a deadly and very public power struggle happening within one of the main Kurdish parties, the PUK, based in the city of Sulaymaniyah. It's between two powerful cousins, Bafal Kalabani and Lahur Talabani.
And this isn't just political backbiting.
No, this is violent. Back in August, their factions were reportedly fighting each other, using armed drones and even tanks, right in the city. At least 5 people were killed. Baffle publicly accused his cousin Lahur of plotting to assassinate him and his entire family.
Wow. What does this mean for Kurdistan's autonomy?
It's deeply worrying for Kurds. This internal conflict reflects wider problems of endemic corruption and economic stagnation within the Kurdistan Regional Government, the KRG. These internal rivalries have weakened the KRG significantly, causing it to lose much of the treasured autonomy it had gained after the 2003 U.S. invasion. The whole project of Kurdish self-rule, once seen as a beacon, feels threatened by this infighting.
Okay, let's shift tone completely now to a life dedicated to legal and cultural bridge building. We have the obituary of Jerome Cohen, who's described as China's most optimistic critic. He passed away at 95.
Cohen's life really personified the potential and the challenges of deep, critical engagement with an authoritarian state like China. He was a legal scholar who fundamentally transformed how the West studied Chinese law. He didn't just rely on official texts. He built his scholarship on extensive, detailed interviews with refugees, with officials, really trying to understand the system from the ground up. He managed to bridge this kind of hawkish skepticism with a genuine, enduring hope for China's future.
And he wasn't afraid to challenge power directly, even back in the 70s.
Not at all. There's this famous story from 1972. During the chaos of the Cultural Revolution, he got a meeting with Zhu Enlai, who was Mao Zedong's number two, and Cohen used the meeting to press for 3 things: the release of a specific political prisoner he knew about, setting up student exchange programs between China and America, and even encouraged China to join the International Court of Justice.
Encouraging communist China to join a Western institution in 1972.
Exactly. Apparently, it earned him a big laugh from Zhu Enlai, but it just showed his audacity, his willingness to push the boundaries of dialogue, even in the toughest circumstances. Later in the 1980s, he became one of the very first foreign lawyers allowed to practice in China, but he did it while simultaneously, relentlessly advocating for human rights and legal reform.
And even as Xi Jinping has overseen this return to much tighter authoritarian control, Cohen apparently maintained his optimism.
He did. He remained steadfastly patient. Having lived through the Cultural Revolution, the Tiananmen Square crackdown in 89, he seemed to see Chinese politics in cycles. He believed that repressive periods wouldn't last forever. He was quoted saying, with quiet confidence, that Xi's rule will not last forever.
That's quite a statement.
And he apparently liked to end his critical analyses by quoting the title of a popular Taiwanese song, which captures his enduring hope: tomorrow will be even better. It's just a remarkable legacy, combining sharp legal rigor with his deep human optimism.
Okay, finally, we end on a truly fascinating cultural detail. Something that seems to completely defy all modern business and technological trends: the unlikely thriving success of a print newspaper called Dai Mainichi Post.
This is such a fantastic anomaly, isn't it? While print newspapers are declining almost everywhere else in the world, this German language paper, which is actually printed up in Canada, has apparently doubled its sales since 2002. It now circulates about 10,000 copies across North and South America.
And the business model depends entirely on its readers rejecting the 21st century.
Pretty much exactly that. Its readership consists overwhelmingly of conservative Mennonite colonies, especially those in really remote areas of Bolivia and Paraguay. These communities explicitly shun most modern technology. No mobile phones, no internet.
And education levels play a role.
Yes, many of the young people leave formal schooling around age 13. So in many homes, the only book besides the Bible might literally be the Mennonitish Post. It becomes their primary, sometimes only, link to the wider world and a crucial communication channel connecting these highly dispersed traditional communities across the Americas.
It must be the only business model left where actively avoiding technology is your core competitive advantage.
It absolutely seems to be. The paper is even written intentionally in simple, very accessible German, knowing its readership's educational background. And apparently half of every single edition is just dedicated to letters sent in from readers in these remote colonies, sharing news of births, deaths, marriages, crop sales, weather, just the fabric of community life.
And their demographics help too.
Massively. Conservative Mennonite couples often have very large families. 8 or more children is not uncommon. So
Purely
from a demographic perspective, they have this constantly renewing, growing readership base for traditional print media that will likely last for decades to come. Just fascinating.
It really is. And that brings us towards the close of our deep dive this week, looking at these political, economic, and cultural snapshots from early October 2025. We've covered a lot of ground, from the really high-stakes institution-bending policymaking in the U.S. To the growing global challenge of this ambiguous gray zone aggression.
And finishing with the surprising resilience of certain communities, whether it's human taxi drivers in San Francisco or Mennonite newspaper readers who seem to be carving out niches against the tide of technological change.
And understanding how all these different tensions, political, military, economic, technological, interconnect, is just essential, I think, for navigating the really complex era we're in. We've seen powerful actors, whether in Washington, Moscow, or Beijing, consistently pushing the boundaries of established rules, often operating with a degree of impunity in that murky gray zone. So the question this leaves us with, for you, the listener, is this. We've talked a lot today about how leaders seem to be finding success, or at least aren't being immediately punished, for blurring the lines politically, militarily, even constitutionally. Think about weaponizing government shutdowns, using deniable drone attacks against NATO infrastructure, chipping away at trade deals. If the powerful are consistently rewarded for operating in this pervasive gray zone of ambiguity, what happens to the core black and white rules? The laws, the treaties, the democratic guardrails, the basic norms that arguably the world has relied upon, however imperfectly, since 1945, where does that leave us? That's the critical question we want to leave you to think about.
Yeah, the shape of whatever new world order emerges might just depend on the answer to that question.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.